We held a meeting at the university on Wednesday, and we heard from 33 of the native students on the campus. We came downtown yesterday and had a meeting yesterday here, and heard from about 17 or 18 people altogether, I think. And so we said we'd remain today and then again tomorrow morning, just in case there were others that still wanted a chance to be heard. So here we are. I think you all know that this is the Alaska Native Review Commission, and that I'm going around the state to each region to discuss the impact of the land claim settlement of 1971, the way it's worked out, the good points and the bad points, the questions that have come up for 1991 about sale of shares, the taxation of native land, whether or not the children born since 1971 should participate in the settlement, sovereignty and native government, all of these questions. People have been bringing these questions up at the meetings we've held so far. We've been holding meetings since February, and I'm glad you have turned out this morning, and I want to give you an opportunity now to say your piece. So with that, the floor is open. If you want to step up here and speak at this microphone, what you say will be taken down on tape and then transcribed, and we're arranging to send the complete transcripts of all the hearings to the University of Alaska here in Fairbanks, so they'll be available to you. Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask you a couple of questions.
Could we have your name? Could we have your name, sir?
Harold Henry.
Thank you.
What has effect on ANCSA? What does that mean?
Oh, I think that the question is what effect has the land claim settlement had on you and your family and your village and your town? That's all.
Okay. The land should be held by the corporation where it can affect you more than it would be held by individuals. How does town or village want to use its land for development and profit making? What kind of government does or would do the best land in your village? It's traditional council. Because those people that are older than us, I'm a retired military, but they're wiser than us. And is your town or village interested in doing business? They have been doing business. It's in our property, and we have been doing business for years for our own people. I can't understand what it means. What does it mean to you to be native? We are natives. Should the native cultural heritage be preserved? And how? It's been preserved. So, I can't understand that question. Should native culture be heritage be preserved, and how? It's been preserved by our own especially when you make fish wheels, put fish nets in, make your own canoes, and it's already been preserved. Should shareholders and Native Corporation keep the option to sell their shares after 1991? I don't think so. If they do that, they lose everything. And I just received this Alaska Native Review Commission from public hearing, and I was gonna make in 1971, well, my sons were born in 69. The kind of education or training is most valuable to the people of our town or village. They need high school training and part of college. Responsibility of education and training to be when and where should it be used? University of Alaska. What is the fate future that you wish for your children? They can decide on their own. If they want to go to University of Alaska, then the state has to pay for it. I had my say.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for making those points.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to point out two sections of the Claims Act.
Did we have your name, sir?
Yes, sir. My name is George Tobuk, T-O-B-U-K.
Thank you.
And I would like to point out two sections of the Claims Act that is unworkable. The regulations that govern 14H2 and congressional intent of the Claims Act. The Secretary was authorized to withdraw 23,040 acres for a Native group. Regulations have come about only to grant 320 per person. The largest group in the Doyon region is, 24, actually. The regulations state that they would gain, if found eligible, to 5,760 acres only. And we have nine groups in the interior region, and two have been found eligible. Two are on an appeal, and one virtually gave up. I got tired of fighting the bureaucracy. They entail only 123 people. But Congress sought to find that they would gain title to land. But it doesn't look like they are going to get the full benefit of congressional intent. Also, these groups that are found eligible could get from the Secretary grant money found in ELCA 1413. See, the other area is 14H5, primary places of residence. In the interior region, we have four. Let's see. One has been found approved last year. Two are deceased, and the others are still pending for primary places of residence up to 160 acres. None of them have received title as of yet. The only primary place of residence person that was found eligible will only get 40 if conveyed. Let's see. There is one other area that I work in particular with is 14H6, which entails native allotments. Here in the interior, we have 1,893, which, if granted again, would gain title to about 250,000 acres. Most of them do not receive their full 160 acres. And there was a time frame that the bureaucracy trend has been going on now for, let's see, at least 13 years. And the way the schedule is set up, it'll probably take another 34 years for these people to gain title. I would like to point out that this portion of the Claims Act is not workable. And I don't see how it could be overcome without Congress getting back into the act. Thank you.
You said that there are 1,893 allotments pending in the interior.
Some of them are patented. I don't have an accurate account because it's continuously changing.
But all the 1,893 allotments altogether would come to about 250,000 acres.
About that, yes.
And all of those 1,893 applications were filed before December 18th, 1971, I suppose.
Yes, that's right.
And I take it from what you say, the majority have still not been granted.
Yes. All of those 1,900 are about 200 deceased since filing.
The other point you raised was about the native groups who don't qualify as villages,
yes,
but are nevertheless entitled to some land under
yes.
the Act.
Yes.
And you said that there were nine groups.
Mm-hmm.
Two were declared eligible.
Yes.
Two are still pending.
Two on appeal. Yes.
One had given up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that makes five altogether. What happened to the other four?
There is a line of communication that is complete breakdown between the BIA and the 10 our chiefs, who are responsible under contract with the Bureau of Indian Affairs to look after these people.
How much, the two that were awarded their land, how much land did they get? 23,000 acres or?
No. 300 per person. The figures are there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could you leave this with me?
Yes.
Thanks.
You may.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Very interesting. Yes, Mr. Tannery.
What do you do when people come to our country to infringe on our land, and how do you keep them out? I've got 420 acres of land, but somebody has been trapping and fishing on my land. How do you keep them out? I got the papers to show it to now. There's up Shinjuk River, Porcupine, and Christian River, Crazy Slough, they call it. But somebody has been interfering with that land. So what do you do with it?
Well, that's not a, I'm afraid that's not a question I can answer. That's something that would depend on what advice you might get from a lawyer. It would depend on the title you've got. It would
I
depend.
Already got that title.
Mm-hmm. Well, then I guess you can go to a lawyer and say, see if you can get an injunction to get this guy off. But I can't come out there and kick him off for you. You'd have to go to a lawyer and get an injunction. That's what would usually be done.
I don't know. It's all up to you.
Okay, thanks.
Hello, my name's Dave Lacey, and I've done some historical research on basically, I guess you would call, government and industry dealings as they've affected a village here in interior Alaska. The village is Stevens Village. I guess initially the first contact with outsiders, the people in the village basically accepted and helped, those first miners and the river boats and things like that come up and down the river. But anyways, we come to the era of the IRA era, which is at least is in my research that I've found contact with the government. as you know, the IRA was made applicable to Alaska in 1936. And in December of 1939, excuse me, Stevens Village was issued an IRA constitution and an IRA charter for a corporation. In March of 1939, the people also applied for an IRA reservation, which the Secretary of the Interior was authorized to provide for the people if they met certain requirements and all. And they there was enough people, there was a petition signed. I'm going to let you have all these documents here. But you'll see that the people signed the petition requesting a reservation be made under the provisions of Section 7 of the Act of May 1st, 1936. And I have here a copy of a letter. There were some questions. People didn't quite know exactly what reservations meant, whether it was really going to restrict their freedom. There had been a lot of negative publicity about reservations. But anyways, they did apply for the reservation there in 1939, and it was received by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Here I have the resolution for it here. This is a council resolution. And anyways, whereas the people of Stevens Village depend in large measure upon wild meat and the annual catch of fur-bearing animals for their health and living, be it therefore resolved that a reasonable area be included in a reservation which contains the breeding and living grounds of these animals to the end that effective local control measures may be taken to ensure that in future years these animals will not completely disappear. I think an important thing is effective local control measures. In other words, the people did want to manage their local fish and game resources, feeling they were the best ones to do that. Anyway, be it resolved that a reasonable area along the banks of the Yukon River be set aside as a reservation for the sole and exclusive use of the natives of Stevens Village. And here's a map that they've drawn out in making the application. And also here's a record here, too, along about this time there was a withdrawal for a town site withdrawal. It was made there for approximately 640 acres, these administrative town sites in Stevens Village. That land was withdrawn also and placed under federal trusteeship. The justification for that was, quote unquote, this is a local caseworker, I guess kind of BIA caseworker. He said, each ship that arrives from the south brings more people who are coming to Alaska with the, quote, expectations of making a quick fortune. Many of these people are fine people. On the other hand, there is a certain percentage of them that have no scruples as to how they make their money, and their easiest prey will be the native people. We respectfully request that immediate action be taken in the case of the proposed administrative sites for the above group of villages. We know that these administrative sites are not the final answer to the problems of these fine native people, but until a definite policy can be worked out by the department as to our future course in regard to the establishment of land reserves for the natives of Alaska, we feel that this is the safest course to follow in the interim.
That was an official of BIA.
Right, this was a local official here, Don Foster, General Superintendent.
What was the date he wrote?
This was in May of 1946. So in other words, that's about like 6 or 7 years later. Basically what I found here, is that the local officials here with the BIA who saw what was going on in Alaska were sympathetic to the need for the local people to have, you know, their land rights in control. But what happened was that the whole system, the Secretary of the Interior, failed to exercise his trust responsibility in going ahead and putting through these reservation applications. And what I found is one of the main reasons for that was that there was a lot of outside pressure on large lobbying and special interest groups, particularly mining groups and all, who did not want, quote, land tied up in native hands because it would inhibit the orderly development or exploitation of Alaska's mineral resources. Now, I'll go through some other, and there was quite a bit of controversy with Congress people and all concerned about this, and of course Congress people from outside who were, I guess, felt that these lobbying groups were part of their constituents and all, and in fact, There was a law, that there was a bill introduced into the House of Representatives in 1953, which the bill was to repeal Section 2 of the Act of May 1st, 1936, which is the IRA Act, and to rescind certain orders of the Secretary of the Interior establishing Indian reservations in the territory of Alaska and for other purposes. That the orders of the Secretary of the Interior under authority of the Act of May 1st, 1936, establishing the Accutan, Diomede, Heidelberg, Karluk, Shismarik, Unalakleet, Venati, Wales, and White Mountain, or any other Indian reservations in the territory of Alaska, are hereby rescinded. Section 2 of the Act of May 1st, 1936 is hereby repealed. The Secretary of the Interior in the territory of Alaska is authorized to issue patents to the appropriate native tribes and villages or individuals for the lands actually possessed, used, or occupied for town sites, villages, smokehouses, gardens, burial grounds, or missionary stations, provided, however, that the Secretary of the Interior, prior to issuing patents to any such lands within the exterior boundaries of a national forest, shall obtain the concurrence of the Secretary of Agriculture. So basically, these people either didn't understand or didn't care about the fact that, among other aspects of subsistence, that it is an economy, and that the people needed to be able to control the land, you know, to be able to, you know, whatever, manage their economy and all. So basically, they wanted to take away all the rights for any land except for just, you know, somebody's house and maybe their smokehouse or their garden and all. So this bill didn't actually get passed, but this was an example of the momentum that this lobbying groups did have in attempting to prevent the local people in Alaska from getting their land rights. And so I have quite a bit of, like here I have a letter from the Secretary of the Interior to a Mr. James F. O'Connor from the House of Representatives. He's questioning about what, and they've been having hearings on the whole thing about Indian title and the sovereignty rights and all. And also here's a letter here from the Secretary of the Interior to a Mr. A.B. Parsons, Secretary, American Institute of Mining and Metallurgical Engineers in New York City. Mr. Parsons had written and expressed concern to the Secretary of the Interior that, quote, regarding the program of this department with respect to Indian lands in Alaska and the possible impact of that program upon the exploitation of mineral resources. Anyways, the Secretary goes on to explain what their program is and tries to allay some of the fears and all of that this Mr. Parsons has. On there has been a studious effort in certain quarters to build up the fear that determining Indian rights or establishing Indian reservations in Alaska would remove vast areas of land from mineral development. Anyway, he goes on to point that there has been mineral development on Indian-owned lands in the lower 48 and all. Okay. Also at the time, the local state officials, which was Representative Bartlett to the U.S. Congress and also the governor, Greening, were also very much opposed to the reservations because they felt that this would hinder quote-unquote development. And they saw basically that assimilation was the best course for Alaska Natives. And here I have some letters from Governor Greening expressing concern about Native reservations and all. Here I have a letter to from Oscar Chapman, the Assistant Secretary of the Interior, to a Mr. George Waterman, President of the West Coast Mineral Association in Seattle, Washington. And he says, "Dear Sir, careful consideration has been given to your letter of October 3rd protesting against the establishment of fishing, mining, timber, and homestead reservations based on the Aboriginal claims of the natives of Alaska. And he goes on to say, I assume that your association is primarily interested in seeing that no unnecessary obstacles are placed in the way of the proper development of the mineral wealth of Alaska. That interest is entirely shared by this department. Your letter, however, does not explain how the recognition of Indian possessory rights or the establishment of Indian reservations can be expected to hinder mineral development. He goes on to explain there has been mineral development on reservations in the lower 48. If your association has any factual data indicating that mineral development has been hindered on any Indian reservation, this department would be very glad to have such factual data brought to its attention. Sincerely yours, Oscar L. Chapman, Assistant Secretary. And here's a record here of the applications for the reservations. Here we see Stevens Village reservations contemplated under the 1936 Act, square mile in area 125, authority and status contemplated, native population 118. But we see that in reality, these outside groups did have a lot of pressure of influence because for some reason the Secretary of the Interior failed to exercise his trust responsibility in setting up these reservations. And here we go on. I have some there's also here some clippings from the local Alaskan press and all. And they very much editorialized and whatever you want to call it, sent out the message that, of the danger of establishing possessory rights for the Native Alaskans. Here we have Representative Jackson. Here's an article in the paper. It says, I hope the new... This is the Juneau Empire or the Ketchikan Empire, March 31st, 1950, in reference to Alaskan reservation election next month. I hope the new Commissioner of Indian Affairs, Dylan S. Meyer, will review the reservation situation in Alaska in light of the restriction written into his next year's appropriation. Jackson had written into the Interior Department appropriation bill a restriction that Indian Bureau funds for the year starting July 1st cannot be used to create any more reservations in the territory. But he said the prohibition will not apply to elections before July 1st. He made his comment in connection with an Interior Department announcement. It will send a representative to observe Native elections at Chudenyak in Heidelberg, April 24th. The elections are to determine whether the Natives there want reservations established for them. The elections were scheduled originally for February. So in other words, they were doing everything possible, the outside congressmen and all, in the way of, limiting their budgets and whatever means possible to slow down the people's desire to establish, their land claims and land rights here. again, here's another article in the Ketchikan Chronicle. Reservation fund ban is explained. Here's another, some more articles. Here's an editorial, quote, segregating the Indians from the Ketchikan News, where they editorialize against them having their own land. here we have something from a letter from Kate Smith, a social worker from the Alaska Native Service. And this is a memo to the area director.
What's the date?
And February 13th, 1950. And she's reporting that Mr. Evans from Stevens Village said the people needed a reservation and cited reasons as encroachment by outside trappers. But I reminded him that I wasn't out to urge natives to vote for reservations. There was a lot of controversy. The local people who were working, there was a lot of pressure on them from the government and also the development interest who claimed that they were promoting reservations to the native people and all. So they were being very careful that they weren't necessarily promoting reservations to the people, that they were just trying to explain to them what is going on. Here we have an article in Alaska Sunday Press, 2/17/50. titled Investigation Minded. This is an editorial, I think. Now seems as good as any time to make investigations. Charges and countercharges that attempts at intimidation of Native voters in connection with the Interior Department's election plans for reservations have been floating between Washington, D.C. and Alaska. Now comes a personal investigation of charges by a member of the Alaska legislature from Nome in the 2nd Division. Delegate Bartlett said he would lend every effort to get to the bottom of any such tactics. Secretary Chapman of the Interior Department said he would send someone to Alaska to investigate such rumors. General Superintendent Foster of the Alaska Native Service says he is going to find out who intimidated who. If there is any foundation to these repeated allegations, it would seem a pertinent duty of Alaska grand juries to inquire as to whether there has been any attempt to deny free citizens of Alaska just rights, whether they be Native or white, and whether due benefits shall be denied them in pursuance of bureaucratic programs. If no truth attaches to these charges, after official determination, either administratively or judicially, the public is entitled to know the outcome. So they're investigating. Here we have a record here of the local Senator Bartlett has had these charges investigated and all. Here we have an article here in the Juneau Empire, 210-50. Governor says reservation plan is destructive, is the headlines. Governor Ernest Egan, Greening, said this, that the proposed plan to create reservations for Alaska Natives is, quote, wholly destructive. He was speaking to the Chamber of Commerce at the Baranoff Hotel.
What was the date of that?
2-10-50. Okay.
Did he go on? He said wholly destructive. Did he elaborate?
Let's see. No, this is just summarizing here what he's talking about. He goes on to talk about a bunch of more things. He was in Washington, D.C., lobbying effectively as he can for bills in the interest of Alaska, which may be before Congress, or showing promise of coming up and working against action which would be detrimental to the territory. He pointed out that one of the things he had worked against on his last trip was the reservation plan. Here we have an article in the Ketchikan Chronicle. This is an editorial on 2950, and the title of it is The Wrath of Mr. Bartlett is More Than Justified. And we go on. This is Mr. Bartlett's wrath on the formation of reservations here. Here we have also a letter, like the people were trying to enlist outside help who might be sympathetic for their cause. And here's a letter from Mr. Felix Cohen, who was a well-known expert in Indian law, to Mr. Cyrus Peck, the Grand President of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. And he says, when you asked me to help the Alaska Natives in their struggle to preserve their lands, I hesitated to act. There were two reasons for my hesitation. And anyways, he goes on to
What were the two reasons? Felix Cohen was
okay.
The greatest authority on Native law in the United States.
Right.
I'd be interested in knowing what
okay. In the first place, I did not want to interfere with the work your people have delegated to another lawyer whose sincere views might differ from my own. In the second place, although I have never lost any of my concern over bureaucratic seizures of Native lands, I doubted that the suggested manner of helping my letters to the president was the best thing I could do at this particular time. They were trying to get him to write a letter to the president. He concludes this letter, it says, here, I'll go on to read. There's one thing that your organization, your people can do that will be far more effective than anything I or any other outsider can do. This is to make sure that the beneficiaries of the Fair Deal policy are not tricked into turning down the lands that are being secured for them after the long years of struggle to win these lands. I am sure that terrific propaganda will be unloosed to persuade the Heidelberg, Shunyak, and Barrel natives, for example, that if their lands are reserved for their own use, the reservation will be like a concentration camp, that their citizenship rights will be taken away, and that their right to receive money adjustments for past land losses will be impaired. You and I know that there is no truth to these assertions, and that those who deliberately spread such rumors are hoping to snatch out of the very arms of the natives the quarry they have pursued for so long, and now have within their grasp. I know that you, in your way, will do what you can, as I, in my way, am doing what I can to expose these latest schemes for defrauding the Alaskan natives of their land and for blackening the names of those who have helped your people. Sincerely, Felix S. Cohen.
Pretty good letter.
Mm-hmm. And he also wrote a letter to President Harry Truman, dated January 17, 1950, expressing a lot of these concerns. It's a fairly long letter here, so I won't go into this, but I'm going to give you a copy of it. And there's also a letter from E.L. Bartlett with his wrath on this whole thing. So
Bartlett was governor or representative?
Was the representative for the territory to the Congress, federal Congress. But anyways, we go on. For some reason, the bureaucracy just, you know, stalled out on these reservation applications. A couple of them went through, and they had some elections and all. And here we see here, I have this year, this was, and I'm not sure the date of this, but this were claims before the Indian Claims Commission. And we have here docket number 199 was the Athabascan Indians of Stevens Village. And here's some things here again. They're still contemplating the village, and they set up some criteria here from which to judge the applications in the history of the village and population, economy, social conditions, and also this was in like March of 1942 and all. So they were, you know, the wheels of the bureaucracy were turning, but it was very, very slow. And again, here's some more like letters from the land field agents, the local agents, you know, documenting the need for the reservations, the encroachment on the native lands, this and that. And he makes comparison between the advantages of people in Tetlin at that time had a reserve set up, a reservation, and the people at Northway and Tanacross, who were, their lands were being impacted because of the Alaskan Highway coming through, and there was a lot of their subsistence resources being taken by outsiders.
It says Stevens Village, field work needed.
Mm-hmm. Right, there was always field work needed. But for some reason, the bureaucracy moves so slow on those things. But after ANSCA was passed, I'm going to show you this, within like a month and all, there was a letter from BLM extinguishing all of their Aboriginal land claims. So for some reason, they got out real quick within just a few days. But there was always field work needed. There was always stalling out. Well, now we come to the next era. I think the people in the village were, you know, getting frustrated with what was going on. So in 1950 here, on April 25th of 1950, they made what I guess was known as a Native Assertion of Rights. And I have a copy of this. And this is a petition of the Athabascan Indians of Stevens Village, Alaska. The Indian inhabitants of Stevens Village, Alaska, a native village constituting a band or division of the Athabascan tribe, commonly known as the Indians of Stevens Village, acting by and through the chief and council of Stevens Village State, number one, that the said band or division of the Athabascan tribe has from the immemorial used and occupied the following lands and waters within the territories of Alaska, one, north to and including the Dawl River watershed, to the west as far and including Ray River, to the east as far and including Purgatory, and south to the summit of the range of hills commonly called Roger Creek Range, the lakes and streams therein, and the unpatented lands drained thereby. They're describing watersheds there. Two, that the said band has never sold, ceded, relinquished, or abandoned any of the described lands and waters. 3, that the said band has ever protected against all forms of trespass upon the described lands and waters. 4, that the said band asserts a present claim to the exclusive use and occupancy of the described lands and waters. Wherefore, your petitioner pray pursuant to the provisions of Section 201.21B of the Laws and Regulations for Protection of the Commercial Fisheries of Alaska, 1944, promulgated by the Department of the Interior, that a hearing be held at a time and place certain with respect to the validity of such claim. Signed and dated at Stevens Village, Kilburn George, Chief Lawrence Joseph, Council Member, other Council Members. Now we have something here, a memorandum from the BLM dated February 25th, 1967, subject Stevens Village land claim. Mr. Kilburn George, the village chief, wants to follow up on the land claim which he had made sometime in the 1950s. It had been reviewed in court in Fairbanks with Horace Smoke having been sent in as the village delegates. The village has no record on hand at the present time because it had gone up with smoke when Leonard John's house burned to the ground. They will appreciate it if you could follow up on this through the proper channels, and please correspond directly with Mr. Kilburn George on this matter. Signed, Richard McKinley, principal teacher. Okay, here we have a letter here to Chief George from Dean L. Williamson, Realty Officer from Fairbanks BIA. Mr. McKinley contacted me on your behalf concerning your land claim. I've enclosed copies of letters written on your claim. You will note that the Bureau of Land Management did not accept your claim of 64. This is another. But when this came to our attention, we pointed out to BLM that your claim was based on an aboriginal right and was not affected by the rampart classification. BLM is carrying your claim in the same manner as the other claims in the state. Your area should receive the same consideration as the others. If you have any questions, contact me. Anyways, I think these records establish that the people were still concerned and still pressing for their land claim. But, you know, back at that time, in discussing that time with people from the village, there wasn't anyone that was really that educated who knew, you know, how to, like, come to town and represent the people and you know, the ways of the you know, white man's world here in town and all. And in a sense, they trusted in all that the government would do what it said that it would do. But, you know, unfortunately, that never happened. Anyways, here's another letter here from the field representative to Ross Youngblood, the BLM person here, asking about the land claim status. what's going on with their claims? Why hasn't any action been taken on them? Next, we come to the next era, you might say, which was the Rampart Dam Project. That was where the Corps of Engineers proposed to construct a concrete gravity dam 1,300 feet long, 500 feet high, using a usable head of 440 feet of water. The dam would impound enough water to warrant an installed capacity of 4,760,000 kilowatts, or 2.5 times the capacity of Grand Coulee Dam. The reservoir would cover an area of about 10,700 square miles, or 40 times the storage of Lake Mead behind Hoover Dam. The expanse would exceed that of Lake Erie and would produce more power than any hydroelectric installation in the nation, if not the world. Well, Stevens Village was just going to be, you know, drowned out, I guess, behind that reservoir, just, and I guess, you know, the people didn't get out. They'd be like the moose or the beaver or whatever, just would be drowned out. But that wasn't really particularly one of the concerns of the people who were building this dam, in spite of the fact that they had, at this point, made two land claims and all for the land that was going to be used for this reservoir. Finally, people realized that Rampart's capacity would be far in excess of present or any near future market requirements under any normal load growth forecast, and the thing got torpedoed by economics and all. But they were apparently going to build the dam there. because it was possible or because it was there, you know, using the same sort of thing like why some people want to climb Mount Everest. I found in those Rampart Dam records one of the justifications for building the Rampart Dam, and I'll quote this. This was in one of their studies. Today, Alaska is faced with the tragic results of stranded populations, increased welfare burdens, and all the resultant wastes of human life and dignity. Some 3/4 of the potential labor force of the villages is employed less than 4 months of the year. Resources in most communities, as presently developed, are inadequate to support 1/2 the present population at a minimum family income and level of living, much less absorb a 4-fold increase by the year 2000. Only a project or projects which offer employment opportunities on the scale suggested by the proposed Rampart Project can alleviate the inevitability of a growing welfare role and the depredation of a people worthy of a greater opportunity to realize the American dream. No other project or series of projects has been suggested that offers an equal opportunity to enable the native to be assimilated into the social and economic life of the state and nation. This was one of the justifications for building the Rampart Dam and flooding out the villages there. Well, in response to the inundation of their village, the village made another land claim in 1964. And here I quote from, I'll read from an article in the Tundra Times, July 22, 1963, titled, Stevens Village Makes Blanket Land Claim. Stevens Village has made a move to claim at least 1,648 square miles or 1,054,000 acres. The plan was disclosed to the Tundra Times on June 27th by the Stevens Village Council. The village is on the path of inundation if the Rampart Dam is built. Stevens Village Council also made it a point to mention the village of Rampart, indicating that village might make a move to claim a land area. Rampart also is in the inundation area, has 15 families, 16 trap lines. Neil Simon, who was the chief at that time, goes on to document the village use and occupancy of these lands. There's record of another land claim made in 1964, and here's a copy of the village council resolution. Here's a thing from the BLM to the village council at Stevens Village. This is to acknowledge receipt of the above-noted application. It is being processed. This is this application that they just made. It is being processed, and you will be notified of action taken affecting the case. Please refer to the serial number shown above in any future correspondence concerning this application. They will be notified of any action being taken. I guess the reason they weren't notified is that there was no action taken. But along about the time, a lot of the other villages started making native assertion of rights. And here's a map showing these various village assertions here. Here's some various correspondence from the bureaucrats saying what's been done about these applications and all, and nothing was being done. Eventually, they eventually those land application records were lost and all. And in fact, when we wrote a couple of years ago to Senator Stevens asking him for his help in finding those records, they're gone, they're lost and all. Finally, we tracked them down at that Federal Records Depository in Seattle. Okay. Well, next, the next era that I'd like to deal with is the pipeline era. There was oil discovered in Prudhoe Bay, as you know, in 1968. And Alyeska proposed to build a pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez. This pipeline was going to intersect the land that was traditionally used and occupied from the people of Stevens Village. Here I have a letter here to Mr. Charles Evans in Stevens Village. On January 8, 1971, the State of Alaska Department of Highway filed an application to build a public road from the Yukon River to Prudhoe Bay. Its location would be in the same place as the access road for the TAPS pipeline. The state highway has also a need for gravel to be used to build a road. The road would go through land covered by Native Protest F- that number filed by the people of Stevens Village. We would like to have your comments on this application. If there's no objection, a resolution lifting your protest as to the road. Well, I don't happen to have a copy of this, but the Tanana Chiefs Conference negotiated an agreement with Alyeska to allow them to go through those lands and all for the consideration of $1 and other, quote, future considerations and all. It, you know, I guess that was a classic beads and trinket deal if there ever was one. But anyway, So the Tanana Chiefs Conference, representing those villages up there, secured this. And here we have a letter from TAPS to the BLM, I guess, here, saying, "We have recently obtained instruments of relinquishment of certain Alaska Native protests and claims which affect the proposed alignment of the TAPS pipeline system. Enclosed are copies of two instruments which have been executed by the Copper River Native Association and the Tanana Chiefs Conference. This relinquishment also contains the execution of the residents of the village council of other or other authorized representatives of the native villages of Minto, Rampart, Alakakit, Bettles, and Stevens Village." Well, anyways, when apparently here, that the people after a year or so realized that there, you know, there wasn't going to be any, quote, future considerations, or there weren't any coming and all, they filed suit to get an injunction to stop the pipeline and the haul road from coming across the lands. And here I have a newspaper article headlining, "Stevens Village, Major Roadblock in Start of Pipeline Construction." Anyways, on March 15th, 1939, Oscar L. Chapman ratified a constitution for the Stevens Village IRA. Among the powers granted the villagers was the right to deal with the federal and territorial governments on matters which interest the village, to stop any giving or taking away of village lands or other property without its consent, and to get legal aid as set forth in the Act of June 18th, 1934. On July 27, 1969, the Executive Committee of the Tanana Chiefs resolved that the Secretary of the Interior grant a right-of-way for said pipeline as soon as possible within the TAPS system, when the TAPS system has otherwise met the requirements established by the Secretary of the Interior. The waiver is authorized in the resolution was contingent upon, quote, assurance that natives will receive maximum employment opportunities consistent with law, and the corporations owned or controlled by the Tanana Chiefs and other native regional associations will receive contracts to assist in construction and servicing the pipeline, all subject to agreed upon reasonable conditions and standards. The waiver was in behalf of not only Stevens Village, but the villages, for and in consideration of $1 and other valuable considerations. Prior to granting of the waiver, a complaint filed in Superior Court in Anchorage contends TAPS representatives approached the villages and in promises for the releases said the villagers would receive preferential employment opportunities on pipeline construction work and preferential treatments in obtaining contracts on the pipeline construction. The DNH Development Corporation was organized to take advantage of the promised contract rights and the promises by TAPS at the DNH businessmen and contractors held here Saturday. The remark was made that no non-native corporation contacted wanted to work with the natives in negotiating for contracts. Wolf declares this statement is incorrect, that several companies were interested. Because of TAPS' refusal to live up to its agreement, Wolf contends the natives had no choice but to go to court to invalidate the agreement or waiver, but also asked for restitution of all damages and expenses suffered by the plaintiffs in reliance upon the promises and representation of the defendants. The natives asked for $20 million active actual damages and $20 million punitive damages. While a village suit filed by Stevens Village is considered one of the major stumbling blocks in construction of the Accessor Hall Road or the pipeline, it is not the only stumbling block, blah, blah. But anyway, so when they failed again to live up to those promises and all, then the village went to court with the other in the so-called Six Village suit. And at that point, they received an injunction against the pipeline and all. But all they received was an injunction based on the IRA statute. There was no findings, no effects, no conclusions of law that in that suit. Basically, from talking to the lawyer that handled the suit, I found out that what happened was is that the judge brought the basically the village representatives and the oil companies back into the back room and said, hey, listen, you guys from the oil companies, make a deal with these people. Well, for various reasons, which are now coming to light, obviously that they didn't want to acknowledge these people's sovereign rights. Basically, what happened was that the oil companies went back to their lobbyists or their people in Washington, D.C. and said, okay, let's grease this ANCSCA deal. You know, we'll add more money and some more acres to it and all, and we'll deal with the situation this way. We don't want to make a deal with these people. So they added more land to the ANCSCA settlement and more money and pushed the ANCSCA settlement through, basically, so that they could get their pipeline through. But in the meantime, before that all of this was settled, Hickel, as the Secretary of the Interior, authorized the infamous Hickel Highway, which went right up through the Stevens Village lands and all, where, without getting permission from the village and all, whereby they built this winter road and ferried all kinds of supplies and all from Livengood up to Bettles. And this was one of their arguments for fighting the people on trying to hold up the pipeline to get a reasonable settlement with Alyeska, was that they had all of this equipment and stuff up there already, and this was costing them money, and they had already made this big commitment to constructing the pipeline and had all these supplies and things stockpiled. So they just went ahead and more or less power tripped their way through and all, and then used that as an argument for to deny the people's lawsuit here. That Winter Hall Road has been described, that's known as the Hickel Highway. It's been described as a ecological disaster. Anyway, here's some more newspaper articles on the huge convoys on the ice road and what was going on at that time and them stockpiling all of these things. Well, anyways, along about this time, of course, things were coming down with ANCSCA and all. And right about this time, and again, I don't have any documentation on this, but I do have, in talking with people, Stevens Village was the one village that was not going along with ANCSCA and all, and they weren't going along with the agreement and were opposed.